You're listening to Vet Candy.
Welcome back to another episode of Vet Candy Rounds with the Hollies. My name is Dr. Quincy Holly.
And I am Dr. Tierra Holly.
We'll be right back with more Vet Candy.
This show is brought to you by Merck Animal Health. And we are terribly excited to be here with everyone today for another really cool episode with another really cool guest. And with that being said, I would love to welcome Dr. Heather Kvitko-White to our show. Heather, how are you?
Oh, I'm doing great. Thank you. Thank you guys for having me here. And please feel free to call me Heather.
Okay, we'll do it. Feel free to call me Quincy
and Tierra.
Yes. Okay, and so before we get into the content of it all, we just want to remind everyone about Vet Candy Rounds and what it's all about. So if you can remember back to veterinary school, for those of you who are already veterinarians, who've already graduated from veterinary school, when you were in vet school, there were rounds with the clinicians and with the experts and things of that nature. And so we've basically recreated it, that same field with Vet Candy Rounds. And so what we do is we bring in really cool guests who have an expertise in one of the specialty areas, and we go over oftentimes what we call a mystery case. And so today Heather has a mystery case for us. So with that being said, Heather, can you just give us a little bit about your background and things of that nature? So your veterinary background, as well as your background as it relates to your family, where you're from, and things like that.
Yeah, so, I'm a veterinarian. I'm an internal medicine specialist. I was out in practice for 7 years after I finished my residency. And just recently, I actually left clinical practice. And now I kind of have my own thing going on. And it's fantastic. It's allowed me to do really cool stuff. The thread that ties everything together for me is that, you know, I call myself the pragmatic professor. And a pragmatic or very practical approach to veterinary internal medicine and kind of educating about that topic's kind of everything that holds together all that I'm doing right now. So, you know, I get to do it all, including talking to you guys today.
Wow, that's really exciting, really exciting. And when I was reading your bio, I was like, I can't wait to do this episode with Heather, because it was really cool to see you go off on almost like an entrepreneurial sort of journey, right? So you branched out from doing clinical practice into your own thing. And I just love the way you have everything set up. And so you do a lot of speaking too, is that right?
I do. Yeah, I do a lot of lecturing. So I do some writing for couple different publications. I still do some locuming. So you may find me in your veterinary school, depending on which school that you are at. I do some telehealth and just really neat stuff. And it's allowed me to kind of piece together, just really picking and choosing everything that I love. I do some industry consulting. And again, with the general concept along the way of like, just let's be pragmatic, let's be practical. I practiced medicine in a situation where it was pretty much just me and my brain on ultrasound and my scope, and just doing a lot with very little. And so that's kind of what I'm here to share. And so I have, you know, really cool case to share with you guys today. It's got a lot going on. And I should say I'm also a consultant for VIN. I've been on consulting for the urology and nephrology boards for, I think, almost 7 years, to be honest. So these are the types of cases that we deal with a lot when it comes to the urinary tract. So I'm excited. That's one of my favorite subspecialties, and I'm happy that we get to talk about it today.
Absolutely. That's very exciting. I think that it is very cool that we're starting to see more and more veterinarians go the more entrepreneur route and take a less traditional approach to veterinary medicine. When you said that you do like locum work for vet school sometimes, tell me a little bit about that. How does that work? Do people call you to come in and kind of like come in as like a replacement for the internal medicine specialist at those locations?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's no shock to anyone that there's a shortage of veterinarians across the board, and that includes specialists, that includes academic specialists. That's a really hard job for all of you veterinary students out there. If you could even imagine, you know, these academic clinicians are actually doing four jobs simultaneously. So they're teaching the students, they're teaching their residents, they're conducting their research, you know, and doing service for the university. And so, you know, just like we all need a vacation, those folks need a vacation sometimes. So it's really great for someone like myself who I can come in invigorated and you know, get to interact with students and residents when I spend a whole lot of my time, you know, kind of working behind my computer screen. So it's really mutually beneficial, and I just love it.
And I noticed that you have two daughters as well. Is that correct?
I do.
What ages? How old are they?
Oh, they are, I think, similar maybe to yours. So they're pretty close in age. I have one that's 3.5 and one that's just about 5.
Wow. Yeah, so that's pretty close to ours. So we have one that is almost, she'll be 6 in June, and then we have one that is 2.5. So
lots of fun, super exhausting.
We hear you there.
Okay. Well, all of our listeners are here today to hear about a mystery case that deals with the urinary tract. And so the way we typically kick this off is that we ask you, Heather, for an initial history, what the initial complaint is of the owner of the pet. So if you can give us, like, you know, signalement, all that good stuff, we'll go ahead and kick it off and get started from there.
Okay. So today we're going to talk about a case named Baby. And Baby is a 4-year-old female spayed English bulldog. And she was presented to me for further evaluation of chronic UTI. So UTI. And so I'll stop there. Or do you want me to give you, because it's a referral case, I certainly can give you the whole history on all of her background data, but maybe we'll stop there with just UTI.
Okay. Mm. So we have a 4-year-old female spayed English bulldog that is presenting for a chronic UTI, and that's per the veterinarian referral, not just the owner's. Is that right?
Yep, that is my referral paperwork that I have.
I guess to give our audience a little bit more information, what types of treatments and therapies have already been instituted? And I would guess that if it's a UTI case, then they've probably already done what?
I'm going to assume they've at least done urinalysis on this dog. And I guess from a chronic patient, they've probably done it a few times at least.
Yeah, they have. And the reason I paused at chronic UTI is a couple of things, because I hate semantics in the real world. And my husband's way better at arguing semantics than I am, so I always lose. But in veterinary internal medicine, I think it's really important that we have our nomenclature and that we understand what we're talking about. So I absolutely hate UTI. It makes me just cringe, because what does that mean, urinary tract infection? And how do you present for urinary tract infection, right? Those are not symptoms. That's an abbreviation that for a diagnosis. Really, when we're talking about urinary tract infection, we could be talking about infection of the bladder, the urethra, of the ureters, or of the kidneys. So really the most appropriate term that we would use would be a bacterial cystitis. And then of course we have chronic, which in lots of diseases means usually something around 3 to 4 weeks at least. In urinary tract infections, chronic could be really 2 urinary tract infections within a 6-month period of time. So it doesn't necessarily have to mean, you know, that we're doing this over 3 weeks or that we've had symptoms for 3 weeks, right? Most people wouldn't let their dogs go for 3 weeks with symptoms.
And so for Baby, was it truly, I guess, a chronic case by your definition and your standards? And if not, can you give us like a little bit of the backstory, the back history? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so I'm gonna tell you the history, and then I'll ask you guys what you think about that question exactly. So hang in there. It's a referral case, so that means there's a lot of history right before it comes to me, and we can talk about later if we feel like it's an appropriate amount of history. So she was originally presented to her vet on January 4th of 2020 for a suspected UTI, and this is what's in the medical records. So a suspected UTI, when I hear those words, to me, I'd like to assume we're talking about things like hematuria, stranguria, plaquiuria, right? UTI doesn't describe whatsoever the symptoms, but as a referral the referral internist in this case, we don't really know because it wasn't listed. So this is the information that we have. So they did a urinalysis in-house. It was free catch. And I always want to know as an internist, was it send out UA or in-house UA? Was it free catch, cysto, or catheter sample? And that's because those answers matter, right? We veterinary professionals and our staff are not very good at doing urinalyses in-house. And it's because the laboratories, have equipment that costs 10 times more. So, you know, us on our, you know, $1,000 microscope versus the highly trained individuals on their $100,000 piece of equipment. But so this was a free catch UA performed in-house, and the urine specific gravity was 1040. The pH was 8, and they noted cocci and too numerous to count white blood cells. So that was her initial diagnostic test. What does it mean? What is the relevance of whether that was a cysto or a free catch urinalysis?
I would imagine with a free catch, we're going to see maybe more bacteria that could have nothing to do with the actual urinary tract, so to speak, right? So it could be from the vulva in and of itself, right?
Absolutely. So one of the things, you know, sometimes we need to compare these results to a cystocentesis sample and see if it's repeatable. But at that time, that was the diagnostics that were done, and she was treated with a dose of Pen-G and a dose of dexamethasone, which was equivalent to about a half a mg per kid pred dose. And she was started on amoxicillin for 10 days. So she was basically diagnosed with what I would call a presumptive UTI. And her case was a little interesting because she was treated with antibiotics and steroids. We don't see that a lot. But I think once we read on, I think that was done because of the significance of the hematuria that they were seeing, but that comes later. So just so you know, obviously I don't typically treat my urinary tract infection cases with steroids. And we'll also talk about the 10-day duration of amoxicillin. That would be 5 times longer than I would personally prescribe, but it's not wrong to prescribe antibiotics for the first time in a suspected UTI, okay? A couple weeks later, 10 days later, they brought her back. The owners brought her back. And this time the complaint was accidents in the bed inside the house. So at that time they did a free catch urinalysis, which had gross hematuria. So gross hematuria means the urine looks pink compared to microscopic hematuria, right? And they did a single lateral radiograph, which did not demonstrate stones. And so what do you guys think? What might you have done at that time?
One question I have was when they did that initial urinalysis, did they collect a sample to do like culture and sensitivity on that urine at that time?
They did not.
Gotcha. And one other piece of the history with the inappropriate urination a case like this as well, I would want to know like what are the water drinking habits, if there are any other signs, because there can be other signs or other causes of, you know, inappropriate urination as well, from endocrine types of things and all that jazz. So was there any other history as it relates to that? Blood work that was performed or...
No blood work, but the owners did say one of the things that was bothering them was how much she was licking back there.
Okay, so she's licking quite a bit. When was she spayed? Was this a recent spay? Was she spayed at, you know, early on, 6 months or?
Yeah, that's a great question. So she was actually spayed at about 10 months of age, and she did not have a hypoplastic vulva. But I will say that that's certainly something that I see very, very frequently and can cause a hole. I'm personally a proponent of delayed spay until after first heat for any female dog that's in kind of a predisposed breed. So like a Labrador or a Golden, or if they've shown any lower urinary tract symptoms at a young age. So, you know, less than 6 months, and every once in a while we'll have these dogs that start to show symptoms. So in those cases, I always wait, even if it's vaginitis, until they've had their first heat to allow that anatomy to sexually mature and help them out in the long run. And that's a bit controversial, right? Because we're talking about going against, you know, our lifetime of history of we have to spay them early because of mammary cancer. Now, as an internist who practiced in private practice, I can tell you I did not see hardly any mammary cancer, but I saw these cases every day.
Yeah, right, and I have to, I definitely agree with you there. And it is difficult because you're going against kind of what you were initially taught, like especially in vet school, as far as when you're supposed to spay, you know, and neuter a pet. And I definitely agree with you there.
Yeah. And it's hard. It's really hard. Change is always hard in life. But I will tell you that being adaptable to upcoming recommendations, and as research expands and our knowledge grows, being adaptable is being pragmatic. And again, pragmatic is cost conscientious, common sense approach to caring for animals. So you'll see as we go through this, how actually a lot of the changing guidelines allow us to save a lot of cost. So not to spoil the ending, but you know, I'll tell you that if you look at the updated International Society for Companion Animal Infectious Diseases, their updated recommendations for urinary tract disease and urine culture monitoring, we don't have to do very much urine cultures anymore. And that's a huge thing. People are really struggling with that, but we're recommending no longer culturing urine after antibiotics, no longer culturing urine unless there's clinical signs. These are really hard things to adapt to, generalists, specialists alike. But if you can remind yourself of the cost-saving benefits to adapting to what the research shows us and what they do in human medicine, all of a sudden you can find a way to get really comfortable with not submitting a culture because those are expensive. Yeah, so in this case, so I mean, as we go through this, I will spoil the ending here. No urine culture was performed until transfer or until consultation. But so at this point, she was treated again with antibiotics. Go ahead.
Right, right, right. So I did have a couple other questions too, as it relates to the physical exam. I'm just curious if she's overweight and if we have like excessive skin folds and things of that nature, any bacterial disease near the vulva, anything like that?
Yeah, so that's a great question. She is every bit of an English bulldog. She could be, I'm sure, your favorite football team's UGA's mascot if she wanted to be. And she had every bit of conformational flabbiness, I suppose we'll say, as every other good old English bulldog. And she actually, and I should have mentioned in her history, her chronic history, she has a history of atopic dermatitis and has been on and off Apoquil now for about 2 years. And at this point in time, by the time I saw her, she had been on it for about 4 months back on it.
Okay. Right. I think, you know, Apoquil is like candy for bulldogs. You know, it's it's hard to find one who doesn't need it.
Right. Well, you know, and I mean, most of us internists are kind of terrified by, you know, but I think it is a safe medication as long as monitoring. But there have been studies done with both Atopica and Apoquil that show that it, at least in healthy dogs, I think the Apoquil study so far is just healthy dogs that showed it did not increase risk of UTI. In the Atopica study, they looked at at-risk dogs, so dogs with a history of urinary tract infections in the past, and it showed that they are at increased risk. And I believe that Apoquil probably does the same thing. We just haven't seen the study yet. So just something to keep in mind. And, you know, collecting all of this history, whether you're an internal medicine specialist or whether you are the primary veterinarian, again, or a second opinion, collecting all this history is absolutely critical to figuring out these cases. And if we never ask, we don't know. So good for you guys on asking those extra questions. Yeah.
So how was her diet? Like, what type of diet was she being fed at the time?
You know, that's funny because I don't have it written down anywhere, but I remember specifically from this, a real case, that she was eating Biljack. Because what English bulldog does not get Biljack?
That's fantastic. That is fantastic. And expected. And I'm imagining that she's up to date on vaccines, lepto, things of that nature.
Oh, yes. She's very well cared for, very well loved, as these girls always are, right? They always are.
They always are.
And so the last piece of information you gave us was that she had urinated in her sleep. Prior to that, was it polakiuria? Did you say, was she having like frequent urination? No, that wasn't a part of the history?
Nope. It's coming though. So up at this point in time, the only thing she really presented for was licking. And that's what took her in the first time. And then when she went back for recheck, she had had some potty accidents in the bed at night while sleeping. And when they looked at her urine, there was gross hematuria. So the urine was pink.
Gotcha. Okay. Gotcha.
So how did she do after this course of antibiotics that she was...
So this time, Baytril once a day for 7 days. She did okay on the Baytril, but within 2 weeks, she was back, this time for increased frequency and urgency of urination. The blood in the urine was gone. And at that time, the veterinarian did a spot bladder ultrasound, which suggested a thickened bladder wall and a possible hyperechoic structure near the trigone. I do not have access to those images, so we just have to go off of what we see. And a recheck pre-catch UA was 3+ blood, suspect rods, 2 to 3 white blood cells per high power field. The specific gravity was 10.44 and the pH was 6. So why are those things important? What her specific gravity and her pH are?
Specific gravity is showing that she can, in fact, concentrate urine. And I know with a lot of the kidney-based diseases that oftentimes we can have isocyanuria, which could show that they are having difficulty concentrating that urine. And then with the pH, certain crystals and stones form at certain pHs, and maybe even bacterial growth is more likely at, I think, a more alkaline, so the higher that pH, right, as opposed to acidic?
Yeah, so the pH, an alkaline pH, indicates that there are bacteria in the bladder that are causing changes to the environment and creating that alkaline pH, and they do that by production of urease, right? So there are these urease formers that make it a very alkaline pH. And we know that struvite stones, infection-based stones in dogs, form in an alkaline pH, whereas, you know, calcium oxalate stones can really, more and more the literature is showing they can form at any pH, that it really doesn't matter. And then, yeah, the other thing about the urine-specific gravity being that well concentrated tells me that she really probably does not have one of these endocrinopathies. It's not impossible for a dog with Cushing's to have a well-concentrated urine, but it's very rare. So a lot of those things are going to cause dilute urine, hypostenuric even. And so we kind of rule out a bunch of stuff with free, cheap, easy data, right?
Right.
Good point.
Right. And so you said that they also noted like a hyperechoic structure in near the trigone.
Yep. So, you know, could that be a bit of just cellular debris, you know, cellular debris, crystalline debris, a true stone, mineralization of the bladder wall? Could it have just been lipiduria? Cats have a lot of fat in their urine, and they can make hyperechoic things on ultrasound. So I don't know. It's just something that as us now, as kind of the referring vets looking at everything in hindsight, we just have to bear in mind, is there a structural bladder problem? You know, possibly that's something we need to look at further. And I do want to mention that on February 4th, referral was discussed and the owner opted for another course of antibiotics. So she was again treated with penicillin, dexamethasone, and was discharged with Baytril now for 14 days. And one day later, the owner said she was much improved.
Getting into February now, right? So it's started in January of 2020. We've had three rounds of antibiotics, it sounds like, right? So we had amoxicillin that first go around, mm-hmm. Baytrol for 7 days, and then come back. Let's hit them for 2 weeks, right? Let's mm-hmm. go. Okay, it's going to be stronger. And then injectable steroids, it yeah. sounds like, twice.
And okay. And we've done pre-catch UAs up to this point in time. And basically, she actually goes on to have another pre-catch urinalysis and repeat radiographs before coming to see me, which again showed no stones. Actually, I have calculated for this case specifically that they had spent $200 on antibiotics at this point in time. That does not include any cost for seeing their vet or any of the diagnostic tests that were done.
Mm-hmm. And we can't even call this acute or chronic UTI because we don't even know it's a UTI. Yeah. But let's assume that we did have confirmation that it was bacterial cystitis, what have you. We could call it chronic at this point because it's been multiple.
Yeah, you know, this is the thing though, right? Is this dog a chronic UTI? Meaning, is it failing treatment or is it getting a new urinary tract infection over and over again? And I cannot answer that question without knowing what type of bacteria is inside the bladder. So when we think of a dog that has a recurrent urinary tract infection, usually what we see is a different bug each time. So it'll be like an E. coli and then a strep and then a staph, maybe, you know, all the gross stuff that's back there in the hind end of a dog. When it's kind of a chronic failed to respond UTI, it would be that we would do cultures and it would get better potentially and then come right back, or it would be the same bug that just never goes away. So we don't have that information, nor do I ever when I'm doing internal medicine. And the reason is because of how darn expensive it is to do a urine culture, which is why we're going to talk about, you know, where the urine culture would be necessary or indicated and how this case might have been done a little bit differently, right? So finally, when she comes and we get to see her now for our first time, we get to get our hands on her and we see that on physical exam, not only does she have really significant moist perivulvar dermatitis, but actually, and I called it, I made up the term because I didn't know what else to call it, basically entropion of the vaginal folds. So the skin actually rotated in and was touching the mucosa just the way that entropion would affect one of these dogs in the eye. So she had some pretty significant, and she was obese and she had atopic dermatitis and yeasty and everything that you would think of for a female spayed bulldog.
It's a possibility she could just be reinfecting herself over and over again just from that, yeah.
And if I were to make a guess, that would have been my guess once I got to see her.
Mm-hmm. Right. And so we did have this incident, though. And give me the time frame one more time of her peeing in the bed. I mean, I imagine it could happen with the UTI. It could happen with nothing, too, right? I don't know. But
yeah, no, I mean, you're like right on point there that, you know, with bacterial cystitis, a couple of things. One, PUPD is not a clinical sign of bacterial cystitis. It would only be a clinical sign if it was a pyelonephritis, but dogs with pyelonephritis are sick, right? They have back pain. They don't feel, they have a fever. They have an infection, you know, all that crud in their bloodstream. Just remember that. And then also, like you said, is incontinence a clinical sign of bacterial cystitis? Well, as you mentioned, Quincy, it can certainly kind of what I would say more expose an underlying issue, put a little bit extra pressure on a system that maybe is at risk. And so that's interesting. Or is it unrelated? Or is the incontinence the cause of, or a contributing cause to the recurrent UTIs? So we have to consider it from all those angles.
Right, right. And confirm that it's actual incontinence as opposed to her just peeing in the bed, right? Like maybe she woke up and peed in the bed.
Historically, they did. It sure sounded like she just urinated in her sleep. And I think the one thing that was just unusual to me when I read it in hindsight was that they didn't note blood in the urine when she leaked, but then they saw it on that free catch. But then I also had to think, oh, I don't know what color their bedspread is, or, you know, I'm picturing, you know, this nice hotel bedding. There's a bloody pee spot, but probably that's not the case. So I would assume, and we can only assume or presume is probably a better term, that you know, the urination was associated with roughly the same urine that was collected shortly after that event, so that it was an active inflammation or that there were red blood cells in it at the time.
Okay. So Heather's got this dog in front of her and it's been referred. She's noticed the perivulvar dermatitis and the entropion of the vulvar of the vulvar lips. I love that word, by the way.
Sure, some surgeons somewhere are like, oh my God, that's called this, whatever.
Hey, we've got to extrapolate and make stuff up sometimes.
I think everyone knows what you're talking about here.
Right. But so what are we going to do next? We've got a little bit of an incontinence history, something that could potentially lead to a recurring urinary tract infection that makes sense to us. What would you want to do from here?
I mean, I have a couple questions in terms of, like, you know, when they did the ultrasound, what is that in there that could be showing up that way? Like, to investigate that further. And then, you know, at what point do we do that culture to see what's happening there?
And then earlier you guys asked me about blood work, and that also has not been done at this case. So we do know probably her kidneys work because of that urine concentrating ability, but we did decide to do blood work. This case probably could go without a CBC chemistry. She's 4, you know, but she's received all these antibiotics. We don't really know what's going on. I like to bundle diagnostic tests anyway. It's like, you know, if you do these profiles at the lab where it's going to cost $130 to get your urinalysis, for $200, we could get the CBC chemistry, maybe a T4 because she's kind of chunky, even though I know and you know that's not why she's fat, but it makes us feel better. And then as far as culture, yeah, I think this is the appropriate time at this point in time. We're a little bit late, right? Fortunately, her vet had her specifically stop antibiotics before coming. And she had been off antibiotics for at least a week. And she was really clinical when she got there. She was in rough shape. And mom said she almost came in through the emergency service last night to get her back on antibiotics, but she managed to hold out. So we did. We did that plan. We did blood work. We did a urine analysis. We submitted urine for a urine culture. And we did just a spot bladder ultrasound. Again, mom was financially concerned and we wanted to be, you know, with her on that. And what we found on, and it, unfortunately, and I can provide images for you guys if we want to post them somewhere, but basically we found that her bladder was in the proper location. Her urethra was the normal length. We didn't see any evidence of ectopic ureters. She did have a layer of mineralized sediment that appeared possibly adhered to the dorsal urinary bladder wall. So remember that when you ultrasound a dog and they're in VD recumbency and your probe's coming from here, that this side closest to the probe is the ventral surface and then the side farthest away is the dorsal surface of the bladder. So in order for us to know if something is adhered to the wall, what would we have to do when we're looking?
If we want to know if something's adhered to the dorsal wall, which would be furthest away from the actual probe itself, right? So I guess we could change the angle or I guess move the probe to a different location.
Yeah, well, see, we can't though because I can't scan the bladder through the spine and of all the meat of the dog, right? I can only look at the bladder from the ventral surface. So basically all we have to do is stand the dog up and look from underneath. And when we did that in this case, this layer of sediment, we stood there and we watched it for a long time and it just really didn't do a great job kind of like letting go of the wall. It actually, we could see now that the wall underneath was thickened. And so I got a little bit concerned of a specific disease process called encrusting cystitis. Have you heard of that one before?
No, that's a new one, encrusting cystitis. Cystitis. Okay.
That's new to me.
Yeah. Yes, it's fancy. Tiara, you should like this one because it comes from, you know, that there's a crown or a basically mineralization lining a wall of the bladder. And that specifically happens with urease producing bacteria. We see it most commonly with carinibacterium, a so specific bug, and the pH will be really alkaline. And I just didn't know on ultrasound. I was just a little worried. We have that information from the vet before, like how long has this junk been sitting in there? The good news is when we did our ear analysis, the pH was 7. So that instantly told me that I don't think this is a crazy encrusting cystitis, Carinii bacterium thing. We did grow actually basically a methicillin resistant staph aureus, so a MRSA, and it had a high drug sensitivity index. Why do you think that guy might have happened? Do we think the dog started out with MRSA in the bladder?
No, we've probably created some resistant bug with all the antibiotics and stop and starting, things of that nature. Yep.
Yeah, and certainly a prolonged exposure to fluoroquinolones like that will definitely select for drug resistance. Now, I didn't panic because this dog had MRSA in the bladder. You know, antibiotic resistance is not pathology. It doesn't mean that the bug is any worse than any other bug. It just means we have to be more creative with the antibiotics. And in this case, it was still susceptible to TMS. So TMS, did it scare me? I mean, would it scare you a little bit in an English bulldog? And if so, why?
I would have to say I've probably never used it.
Because you're probably scared of it, right?
Yeah, exactly. For that purpose.
Wait, we used it in guinea pigs, didn't we?
Yeah, I've used it in some guinea pigs and things like that. But I have never used it for a UTI case. So.
Well, and the thing is, TMS is a fabulous first choice, even empiric antibiotic. It's broad spectrum. It doesn't have anaerobic coverage, and it's bactericidal. And it's actually really well tolerated by a lot of dogs. There's just those pesky Dobermans that will get immune-mediated polyarthritis. And then we worry about KCS lesions. And so autoimmune disease and drug idiosyncrasies. But remember TMS, it's a fabulous UTI drug, and also to not be afraid of it. And, you know, we talk about vet candy. Well, I've worked with an oncologist previously who every dog got TMS as their, you know, if your neutrophils drop too low. So really TMS is kind of idiosyncratic. It's dose related. Basically, we did a Shermer tear test. This dog was the type of bulldog where it was like profusely tearing, right? You know, but we checked her tears and we started TMS. And how long do you treat for?
5-7 days or something like that for it, or?
You know, I think in hindsight, that would have been totally fine. I, you know, heart over head or, you know, whatever you want to call it. I was just fearful because of the sediment in the bladder that it was going to take longer. Mm-hmm. I gave the dog 2 weeks of TMS. I truly believe that we could have done 5-7 days, just like you said. And, you know, essentially we brought her back at the end of that 2 weeks, and her bladder looked perfect. All of that stuff was gone. Yep. She was just basically had struvite crystals really bad. But when we brought her back, her bladder was beautiful, but she was still licking. And remember, that was what brought her in the beginning. That was the biggest concern to mom. You know, we became concerned about all these other things along the way, but mom was upset about the licking.
Huh.
And I guess, you know, could that have been mostly due to the dermatitis that she had around the vulvar area? You know, should we fix that? You know, should she get a little plastic surgery, you know, back there to kind of fix that area up to make it, you know, those folds not so deep so she can get some airflow back there?
That's an amazing question. And, you know, the answer to that is we don't know, but I can tell you what I did and what I believe. And, you know, at least the last time she was doing well. But, you know, vulvoplasty is lovely. And I will tell you the number one cause of chronic UTIs that I consult for are these female dogs with just bad vulvar anatomy. And I just want to remind people that just because something's typical, so, well, this vulva looks like every other dog's vulva, does not mean that it's normal. So, you know, you have to say, okay, just because we see a lot of hypoplastic or hooded vulvas, not a one of those dogs should have conformation that looks that way. Now, if it's not causing a problem, we don't mess with it. But if they are getting frequent UTIs with a different bug each time, and it's, you know, staph and E. coli and strep, stuff that comes from the skin and the perineum itself, then we really want to look at that vulvar anatomy. In her case, she was obese and she was on this Apoquil, which is an immunosuppressive medication. And she has this incontinence history. And when we looked at her again on recheck, she was still a little bit wet back there. I see this really frequently where it's hard to know for sure, but with her history of truly being incontinent while sleeping, a lot of times these dogs will have just a little low-grade incontinence that, again, something, whether it's bladder inflammation or PUPD, if their kidneys, you know, go into, you know, no longer able to concentrate, will basically kind of declare this little incontinence that keeps it very wet back there, makes the dogs lick, you know, it's moist. So what we decided to do first, because she had so many different things going on, was to take her off the Apoquil, you know, have mom start using baby wipes back there after she urinates, have her wear an e-collar for a while so that she would leave it alone so it could potentially heal, get her on a weight loss plan with Hill's metabolic diet. And we started her on incontinence medications with the plan that if this all continued, the surgery would be the next step.
I love that treatment plan. It's really good. Encompasses a lot of low cost, pragmatic things to your point there, right? You know, e-collar, a prescription diet, maybe a little bit more on the costly end.
Yeah, we could have gotten there probably by changing off of Biljack to something with a better, you know, caloric profile.
And what did we do, you know, sort of as a replacement, like since she was on Apoquil for, you know, allergies, atopic dermatitis, what did we do to kind of replace that?
I sent her to a dermatologist. No, but I mean, honestly, you know, a dermatology consultation is one of those pragmatic things. You know, there's actually studies in press about how owners really get frustrated at about the third recheck of chronic dermatitis, and they start seeking self-referral. And, you know, whether it's an internist, a dermatologist, or a surgeon, at the end of the day, a consultation is just a conversation. And if the owners declined serum or, you know, skin allergy testing or whatever, they're probably still going to leave that consultation with a plan of, you know, a diet elimination trial, or, you know, an anti-itch combination of therapies that are not immunosuppressive. So I was fortunate because this dog's allergies were really seasonal and we were in winter. So she was still on it, but was really not symptomatic. So she didn't need anything right then. But that meant, you know, the conversation that I had with mom is you have basically till spring to get to a dermatologist and make a plan.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think with the perivulvar dermatitis as well, the licking can exacerbate that in and of itself. And so maybe it's not even related to her supposed allergies, right? Mm-hmm. That could just be a thing of incontinence plus foals plus saliva,
all
right?
All that extra moisture back there.
Because I wouldn't even think that isn't necessarily the allergy sign. I'm looking for, you know, axillary, inguinal, and, you know, ventral neck, ear infections, paws, things of that nature, but not necessarily the vulva. So how did baby end up doing with her weight loss plan? How long has it been? And how are things looking back there in the private area as well as with the licking?
Well, unfortunately, as is common with being an internal medicine doctor, you know, when they're doing well, I never see them back or I don't get any phone calls, you know, but I do know that she did great. She did great. And we rechecked her, I believe, 2 months. I did not for a urine culture or anything like that, just to check in and see how she was doing. And because of the incontinence medications. And at the time she had gained weight. She had not lost an ounce.
Right. Yeah. That's pretty typical. And then, so I guess with the incontinence medications, we have like phenylpropanolamine, and then there's another class that I've never used, which are the estriols.
Oh, estrogen. Yeah. Well, I preferentially go with estriol, which is kind of the newer of the estrogens. And there's a couple reasons. A, it just seems to work better in my hands. I've not had a ton of success with PPA, But I am also seeing always the more complicated cases because, you know, incontinence doesn't come to see me unless it's failed drug therapy generally. But with specifically with incontinence in cases that have chronic urinary tract infection as part of it, what I like about the estrogens is that we know that in women, as they age and become estrogen deficient, that they get very thin lining of their vaginal tissue, that they become predisposed to bacterial infection. And so there's kind of a double benefit there for not just treating the incontinence, but also getting a little bit of estrogen back into the system, you know, because estriol's FDA approved and the other is half the compound and not quite as safe as far as the safety profile. Equally effective, I would say, but we really just with estriol, we just really don't see side effects the way that we have with diethyl sulbestrol. So I used to be estrogen over phenylpropanolamine, but now I'm, you know, estriol over diethyl sulbestrol. And there's, but other lots of internists do it the other way too. Like there's really no right or wrong. I just, for chronic UTIs, and I happen to see a lot of them because of, you know, my hobbies in life, I particularly prefer having estrogen back in the body. And we would not do that in a male dog, right? They don't need estrogen in their body.
Yeah. Sure. And now with the incontinence medication, when it came back for the recheck, is this something that you will wean them off of or take them off of to see if it comes back, to see if it works? Or would you just say, hey, or do you taper it down? Like, what do you do with that typically?
I mean, I would definitely taper it to the lowest effective dose, which for some dogs can be just twice weekly, you know, just the way we remember with the older estrogen compounds. You know, in my hands, I've found that the taper has to be sometimes painfully slow. So this, you know, treat for 2 weeks before initiating taper, that's not been my reality. Sometimes I'm tapering over the course of a year, you know, and we're going in these baby steps. Those are usually worst cases of incontinence. But, you know, in a case like this, I would get her on a very low maintenance dose, whatever is maintaining everything, and just leave her on it. Because if she's already done this once and kind of declared her underlying incontinence, what's the next thing that's going to happen? Her kidneys are going to start to lose concentration. I mean, it'll come back, you know. So better in her case with all of her anatomy to just kind of keep it dry back there. Keep it dry.
Gotcha.
Yeah,
gotcha.
But that, I mean, that's a terrific case. I mean, I think that it's so awesome. Like for an English bulldog, for you to have been able to, you know, treat her and help her with her issues, it's incredible. It is a challenging breed of dog to have when it comes to like just pet ownership, because they do tend to develop these things that are going to require long-term care and tend to, they like to be overly complicated. Actually, I recall having an English bulldog as a male that probably seen a couple of other vets at some point for urinary tract issues. It's actually, he ended up having urate stones. He was not able to process protein, and he would happen to be having been fed a blue buffalo, you know, for forever, you know, a higher protein grain-free diet. And so we ended up having to surgically remove that, but you know, it couldn't be simple, you know. It couldn't be simple, you know. English bulldogs, it's never that way with them for some reason. But
well, this has been a really, really cool case. We really appreciate your time and your expertise. I've learned a lot today, and that's honestly why I love Vet Candy Rounds for myself personally, because I get to come and pick your brain as the expert on these different cases. And so I'm relearning some of the things that I learned in vet school, which is always great. Always keep learning is one of my favorite quotes from somebody probably a lot smarter than I am, but I love to always keep learning. And so thank you, Heather, for coming and sharing this case with Baby with us here today. And so how can people follow you? Are you on social media? Do you have a website and all that jazz?
Oh, yeah. Well, you can find my website at thepragmaticprofessor.com and the same Instagram handle. And, you know, like I said, I'm just kind of happy to share a little bit about pragmatic medicine and cost savings and kind of approaching really complicated issues with not much else other than your brain and a couple of diagnostic tests. So
I absolutely love that.
Yeah, and we really need that in our profession today, where we're still practicing quality medicine while also being conscious of what's practical for the owner, what's practical for the pet, and things of that nature. And also, in some cases, was practical for the team and for the veterinary professionals. So yes. So we love what you're doing. We hope you continue to do it. I'm sure we'll see more of you everywhere. So to all of our listeners, thank you for tuning in to another episode of Vet Candy Rounds with the Hollies. Please be sure to follow us at My Vet Candy and subscribe to this channel and to this podcast. We really appreciate your support and for tuning in and always keeping learning with us. And so with that being said, this does conclude another round of Vet Candy Rounds with the Hollies. I'm Dr. Quincy Holly.
I'm Dr. Tierra Holly.
All right, everyone, take care.
Vet Candy.
Vet Candy.
Vet Candy.
It's Vet Candy Radio.